Well, as we start this morning, I'd like you to close your eyes, or at least metaphorically close your eyes, and imagine you are watching your favorite sport live. You're there, you're in the grandstand, so you can feel the atmosphere. The players are battling it out in front of you. There is a feeling of excitement that is far and wide, high and low. Sweat is everywhere. The adrenaline is really pumping. And I want you to imagine that you are right there with them, identifying with them. Are you doing it? Are you there? Well, chess, I believe, is one of the most underrated sports in the world today. Thankfully, it gets far more television coverage than it did. But let me tell you, if you have nothing better to do, watch chess. I'm a clergyman. We only work one day a week. I watch it all the time. It's great. It is the most remarkable competition. And if you ever watch some of the geniuses play, say Karpov against Kasparov, that was some 20 years ago, but epic matches, then suddenly, one of them will resign. So he lays his king down and he walks away from the table. It's amazing. Bang, and he's gone. And it normally takes about 3 days to get to that point. But if you've followed it for that long, that point is actually very exciting. And if you're watching it, then you'll always notice at this point, and this is the interesting thing, that there are actually about 100 things you can do without submitting the game. But we're told that these geniuses at chess can actually see 15, 20 moves ahead, and they know that eventually they'll be beaten, and so they resign. And I guess if you or I were playing that game, and we actually may be quite good at chess, there'll be some here who are like that, but we can't actually see that we've got there, so we'd continue playing. That's what we'd do. We wouldn't be able to see it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to say to you that the Bible says to us that the decisive point in the history of the world has come that first Easter weekend, which our passage, Luke 24, refers to. This is God's decisive move in the history of the world. And it has decided the future of the world. For example, it has made conclusive the fact that evil in the end will not triumph. You say that to yourself as you watch the news. In the end, because of the resurrection, evil will not triumph. Is that in your mind? Acts 17:31, for he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he's appointed. He has given proof of this by raising him from the dead. Given proof to all men. For here in the resurrection, God has conclusively declared that Jesus Christ is the Lord of history, King of heaven, and Judge of the world. That is what has happened. That is how decisive it is. And the tragedy in our world today is that many people continue to watch the game and to play the game, not knowing that the decisive move has already been played. That's what they can't see. Now, here, of course, is the question. Rico, how do you know that the decisive move in the history of the world has been played? How do you know that that resurrection day is the decisive move in the history of the world? How do you know that? Well, Luke 24 supplies us with the answer to that question. And I want to ask you now this Easter morning to walk that walk with me that we walk on the Emmaus Road. And as we do that, I want to ask you, what do you make of the death and resurrection of Jesus? Because that's the heart of it as we come to this central point in human history. Now, in chapter 24 of Luke's Gospel, we're introduced to three groups of disciples. Here it is in front of you, page 1061. And the first thing to see, here's the first point, is that they are confused and downcast. That's what we're at. And in all three accounts here, through this chapter, we'll see confusion and people utterly downcast. So the women, can we see Luke 21 verse 1 as we catch the story here and we look down? Can you see them in verse 1? Why are they going to the tomb, these women? Do you see? 1061, there it is. Verse 1, on the first day of the week, now why are they going? Very early in the morning, why are they going? The women took the spices they prepared and went to the tomb. So they had these spices to embalm the body of Jesus. So these women, who are actually the first spice girls, that's who they are, were looking for a resurrected Lord, a risen Lord. They weren't doing that. No, that's what they weren't. They weren't doing that. This wasn't a risen Lord they were looking for, no. They went to do the decent thing to the body. So in verse 4, when two men, two angels in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them, verse 5, in their fright, the women bowed down. The word is actually they threw themselves down in the mud, faces to the ground, They're in total confusion, and then that extraordinary question that rings out through history comes out. Do you see verse 5? Verse 5. Why do you look for the living among the dead? Confused, bewildered, terrified, baffled? What do you do with this news? What do they do with their spices? They bought these spices. They're very expensive. What do you do with them now? And now, in our passage on the road to Emmaus, we find two more confused and baffled disciples. And the key thing is there are two of them, and in a Jewish court of law, two witnesses were required to uphold evidence of an important event. And again, please see, they are confused and downcast. So here these disciples do not know what is going on. They are like a little child with jigsaw pieces. And you can always see the child's mind working as she's trying to put it together. And she can't make a monkey go with half a hippo. That's the problem she's got, and that's where they're at. So please see, they're utterly baffled as the risen Christ meets them on the road. Have a look, verse 13. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. Of course they're talking. They're trying to process this. How do you fit this together? What has happened? What do we do with the pieces? As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. So they can't see. They don't get it. They can't see it's him. He asked them, what were you discussing together as you walked along? Verse 17. They stood still, their faces downcast. Well, they'd just seen all their hopes dashed. It had been the worst weekend of their lives. They'd seen Christ, a paragon of goodness and selflessness, slaughtered by evil men. When? Do you see verse 21? It's so striking. We had hopes. We had hopes. He was the one who was going to redeem Israel. We had such hopes. They had hopes that they'd see him crowned King of the Jews. Instead, the words King of the Jews were sarcastically nailed over the cross above his head when he was dying. King of the Jews. So now they are victims of a deep sorrow they can't sort out because they're having to come to terms with the fact that Jesus, whom they relied upon as their leader, was no longer around to make sense of life, to give them another anchor point, to give them those points of reference we need in life. And he was gone and they trusted in him. And at this point in the walk, we join them. Because what we have here, as we join them at this point in the walk, this is very important, is a picture of life without Christ. Because ultimately, what you have to write over a life that has never encountered the risen Christ, can we see verse 17, is the fact that its faith is downcast. And verse 21, that its hopes are dashed. So that's what we've got here. Its faith is downcast, its hopes are dashed. And that's what we're looking at. And anybody who thinks of life without the resurrection is looking at something that is downcast. That's what we want. You see, these disciples have seen death as the end of Jesus, and they know it will also be the end of them. And that is what life is like without the resurrection, without Easter morning. Anybody who looks at life and says, this life is all there is, there's no eternity, there isn't anything else, well, their life is downcast. They will despair, verse 17. They'll stand still. They'll stop in their tracks. You'll be downcast. Verse 21, your hopes will be dashed. We had hope. We had hope. Now, I didn't believe this, actually, until I watched my grandmother die in 1988. And that experience of watching that dear lady die put me into the ministry. It got me ordained, actually. I was a student. And in many ways, she had led a gem of a life, much-loved member of her village, a loving wife, mother, and grandmother, a good citizen who had done more than her bit in the war. Yet as she died, having neglected Christ all her life, verse 17, her face was downcast. She was depressed. There was no hope. You know, after she died, my mother picked up her purse. She couldn't move. She was in an old people's home, but it was a really sort of semi-hospital. She couldn't move. And my mother found £400 in her purse. That's 1988. And she said she liked to keep it by her. It made her feel secure. And there was a whole area of assurance of God's presence and love that she had never experienced. Rollo May was an American psychiatrist. He wasn't a religious man. And he wrote a book called My Quest for Beauty. Anyway, as I say, he wasn't a religious man, but he was on his travels. He was an educated man. And he was visiting Mount Athos in Greece on Easter Saturday, that's yesterday, in the evening. And that evening, he stumbled on an all-night Greek Orthodox vigil. So he came and he sat down at this vigil outside. And he thought, well, I'll see what the natives are doing. You know, I'll study the flora and fauna. I'll see what the local religion does. That's what a sort of open-minded man would do. I'll see what they're doing. And at the very end of the night, he stayed there all night. As dawn rose on the horizon, the Orthodox priest stood up and exclaimed, "The Lord is risen!" And at that point, all there shouted back, "He is risen indeed!" And Rollo May writes that he also responded, "He's risen indeed!" His heart leapt with it. And then he says, "Suddenly I was seized by a moment of spiritual reality. What would it mean for our world if he indeed was risen? If death wasn't the end, what would it mean?" He suddenly had a moment of seeing that. The Reverend Mark Ashton, some of you will not know this, but he was a clergyman in Cambridge and he died yesterday. So he died yesterday morning. And he was a man of great faith as he faced his cancer. And can I say, his faith was not downcast. So here is a parish newsletter that he wrote last Easter 2009, knowing of the diagnosis. And he said this in the parish newsletter. "I'm sorry for the pain and inconvenience that my death may cause. And I have great sorrow at the breaking of so many precious human relationships. But behind all the relationships of my life stands one relationship. It is the relationship with God which has given me all my other relationships. The prospect of losing them for the sake of seeing him is one that fills me with longing. So my family's real need is for your faith more than for your sympathy. Please believe for us that the gospel is true and that I have received the sentence of life rather than death, something that is a beginning and not an end. The Lord is risen. He is risen indeed." And I was so struck by those words as I heard of Mark's death. Yesterday I rang a widow whose funeral I was at 2 weeks ago, and I read her those words. "The Lord is risen. He's risen indeed." I said, "We'll see him again." She said, "Yes, we'll see him again." Now, wonderfully, Christ does not leave his disciples in this state. Because, you see, they're confused. They're downcast. But he moves from confusion to explanation. And that's our second point. You see, what is interesting here is that disciples know so many facts about Christ, as I'm sure you do as you come along today. So they had so many bits of the jigsaw. I wonder if we can see as we come to this explanation what they've got. Verse 19, do you see, they knew he was a prophet. Well, let's have a look at it now. That's what they knew as we flick this up. They knew he was a prophet. Verse 19. So this is what they knew. They knew he was a prophet. Secondly, they knew, verse 19, that he was powerful in word and deed. Yeah, they've got that as well. Thirdly, verse 20, they knew that he had been crucified. Verse 24, they even knew the tomb was empty. But here's the issue. No one had explained these things to them. They had all these bits of the jigsaw, but they haven't been explained. I mean, that's a lot to know. Prophet, powerful in word and deed. He raised a dead girl. He flung the storm, crucified. Tomb was empty. But it was not enough just to know this stuff. It was not enough to know of the crucifixion. It was not enough to know of the resurrection. They had to have them explained. They had to see, well, why is this the decisive moment in history? You've got to understand them. I mean, personally, I was taken to church for the first 16 years of my life. I was taken at school and periodically I was taken at home, and I speak no word against that now, though I did at the time. But what, however, makes me sad is that I never really did have the meaning of the crucifix explained to me. So both at school and at home, as I remember very clearly, the message was, be good. Be good. That's what we're coming for. We're coming to be good. But you know, the qualification for being Christian is not actually are you good enough, but are you bad enough? Now here is the question. How does Jesus go about explaining these facts? How does he go about turning these facts about him, which the disciples know, into an encounter with himself? We want to meet the risen Christ. We want to know him. Mark Ashton said, "I am longing to see him." How do we get that? How do we find that out? Well, here's the issue. If I was in Jesus' position, having just risen from the dead, I know what I've done. You see, as the disciples, let's have a look down, finish their depressing little speech at the end of verse 24. Can we see what they do here? Some of our companions went to the tomb and found it empty, but him they did not see. What would you do then? Do you know what I'd have shouted? I'd have said, it's me, it's me, it's me, I'm here. It's me, the tomb's empty, I've risen, the show's back on the road. That's what I'd have done. I'd have flung my arms around them. I'd have said, don't worry, I'm back. I mean, you'd have done that, wouldn't you? I mean, if you're English, you wouldn't have flung your arms around them, but you'd have done the rest of it. You know, you'd have come straight out with it. Of course, I mean, are you like me? Good news is so hard to keep to yourself. You'd come straight out with it. I mean, it's so hard to keep good news to yourself. You want to tell people. You're longing to, aren't you? My brother woke me at 3 a.m. to tell me he was engaged. He woke me at 4 a.m. to tell me his first baby had been born. Not on the same night. Not on the same night. They were 5 years apart, those two things. But what does Jesus do? Now, this is very important. Let's have a look, ladies and gentlemen. Let's have a look. Verse 25. He said to them, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. So what does Jesus do? He takes them to the scriptures to explain the facts. It's very striking. He takes them to the scriptures in order to disclose his identity to them. He doesn't jump out on the road. He says, no, Bible's out. Bible's out. So these disciples are going to encounter Christ through the scriptures. This is where a person, here's the issue, supremely meets Christ. So yeah, there are many ways in which we can sense Christ drawing alongside us. Actually, if we went around this church to the Christian believers, and actually to those who are investigating, there are many ways in which you sense the tug of the Lord Jesus. You sense him drawing alongside. But supremely, we meet him in scriptures. Now why? Why does Christ reveal himself to the disciples and to us in this way? Well, the reason is because he wants their confidence and our confidence to be rooted in God's unchanging truth and not in our subjective experience. That is the issue. You see, people often say to me, look, Rico, I'd believe if Jesus would just appear to me now. So if he just appeared, then I'd believe. And I say, yeah. And they say, yeah, no, honestly, if I had a vision of Jesus here and now, then I'd believe it. I've got to see it. And let's say he did that right now. Let's say, actually, he appears right here and now, Easter morning at All Souls, central London. And he's standing there in all his glory. And then you go into the office. I mean, it's just shattering. It's shattering. You go into the office Tuesday morning and you say, do you know what happened at All Souls Easter morning? No, we saw Jesus. We saw him. And what would they say? Get out! They do it with mirrors. They do it with mirrors. That's what they do. That's what they say. Wouldn't they? And after a week of comments like that, okay, people say, well, what's going to happen tonight? Off you go, you know. Maybe I'll see him on the way home from work, blah, blah. After a week of comments like that, you'd say, well, did I really see him? I mean, I wonder if it was a trick. I mean, maybe I talked myself into it. And there were so many people there, and you know what crowds can do. I must have got caught up in it. So what do you need then? Well, you need to see him again. Well, of course, God can do that. I mean, he can reveal the Lord Jesus to you. He can do that. But Jesus opens the Bible for them, and he shows them in all the scriptures all the things about himself. Can we see verse 27? There it is. So that in the clear light of day, any day they liked, however they were feeling, and my feelings in this life go up and down according to whether I've had a Mars bar. And as you can see, I've had a few. But whatever others said to them in the office, they could pull out their Bibles and check it for themselves. So three in the morning, they say, I'm a bit of DNA. I'm stranded in the universe. And they can check it for themselves. And they can say as they look at the Bible, we were not mistaken. So doubtless Jesus took those disciples to Isaiah 53 verse 5, written 700 years before. We had it read to us. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. Those words were written 400 years before the Carthaginians invented crucifixion. And yet, what have they got on them? He was pierced for our transgressions. Jesus says, you see? He says, the Son of Man has to be pierced. Why? To pay for the sins of man. And he said, there it is. It was all predicted. It's all here. You can be absolutely sure it's in the Bible. He showed it to them on the road, and they could say, we were not mistaken. You see, it's so full of stability and of assurance. Now, as I say that, as you'll hear it all told, there'll be some who are here who say, you know, Rico, I'm a bit like, I mean, you know, I know the cross. I sort of know the resurrection. You know, there are lots of facts I've got, but to be honest, I don't see this as a decisive moment in history. I don't at all, really. I mean, I come along because I've always done that on Easter Day. And I'm saying to you, thank you for coming. Please come back. You need this explained. If it's not the decisive moment in history, you've not understood it. You've got to encounter the risen Christ for yourself as the scriptures are explained. Please, it's the most important thing in life that we encounter him for ourselves, because he holds the future. So actually in front of you, I wonder if you can reach for it now, there are these little slips of paper, and I wonder if you can see it there, and there is a course. You see, we've written, and beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures. We'd love to explain these things to you so you can be absolutely certain. And 4th of April, that's today, Easter Day, do you see it's there? And then we're heading for the 12th of May, which is when that course begins. You can fill in a little card, you can pop it in a postbox at the back, we'll get in contact, please come back, have it explained. And unashamedly, here's the issue, unashamedly, as we open the Bible, we'll be saying the risen Christ encounters us there. So the Bible brings us to Christ and Christ to us. And this is so often, ladies and gentlemen, this is God's way of finding God. I don't know where you're looking to find God. This is God's way of finding God. He walks off the pages of Scripture. Please take advantage of it. And again, unashamedly, we have to say, as the disciples did, verse 32. I wonder if you can see verse 32. This is what we'd love your experience to be, verse 32. Were not our hearts burning within us when he talked with us on the road and opened the Scriptures to us? Well, if you see, as you come along, it is a heart-burning experience, because explanation leads to experience. That's what happens. May the 12th, please come. We'd love to see you. Well, I must conclude, and I want to do so by showing you this picture. I wonder if you can see this picture. It's coming up now. It's by Caravaggio, painted in 1601 by that Italian master. It's called The Supper at Emmaus. It's down in the National Gallery, so you can wander down after this service to Trafalgar Square. It's just on the left as you go in. You can go and see the painting for yourself. And can you see, it depicts the moment in verses 30 and 31 in front of us in our passage, when the disciples have urged Jesus to stay with them. So verse 29, he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table, can you see as you look down, with them, he took bread and gave thanks, broke it and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were open and they recognized him. And can you see as their eyes were open? I wonder if you can see in the picture. Can you see one of them is almost exploding out of the chair? And the other, arms are asunder. They suddenly see it. You see, what they've seen here is life with the resurrection. That is mind-blowing. This is life with the resurrection. They've seen it. Now, what did they see? Can you see there is Jesus at the head of the table? What did they see? As he broke bread. Do you not think that they saw the nail marks in his hands? Furthermore, just a couple of days earlier on Thursday night, that Maundy Thursday, they'd heard Jesus say, Luke 22 verse 19, this is my body given for you, as he took bread and broke it. So they recognized him as their minds were triggered by that moment of bread being broken. And they saw the stars and they remembered the words, this is my body broken for you. And Christ's true identity was revealed as he reminded them that he had died to pay for their sin. So to truly redeem us, he pays the price for our sin to set us free. So this Good Friday, this Easter Day, can I say as we look back to Good Friday, there is only one way to get to hell. There's only one way, and many in London choose this. The only way to get to hell is to trample straight over the cross of Jesus. He blocks the way to hell. With scarred hands, he said, don't go there. He said, I have paid in death and blood for you to come home and to be in relationship with the God who knew you on this most decisive moment in history. And the question is, will you join the disciples at the table? Can we flick back? Let's see the picture again. You see, here's the picture. The question is, as we look back, will you join the disciples here at the table? Because Caravaggio, you see, intentionally leaves one place empty. Why? Why? Well, the question is, will you come? The place nearest us, as we look, is empty. It's there. It's for us. But how do we come? Well, we come by humbling ourselves. We come by saying sorry. We come by saying, Lord, I'm coming to you not because I'm a good man, but because I'm a bad man. The qualification of being Christian is not, are you good enough, but are you bad enough? Will you come? Will you come and say what the prodigal son says to his father in that story in Luke chapter 15? I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am not worthy to be called your son. Will you come as the tax collector looks up at the altar and he sees the blood running down from the altar in Luke 18 and he says, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner. Will you come humbly? That's the question. Will we do that? At this most decisive moment in history, as we see how God reconciled the world to himself and raised his son from the dead, will we come and take our place with him?